Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America and James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyan President Kenyatta lifts COVID-19 curfew.
I hereby order and direct that the nationwide dusk to dawn curfew that has been in effect from the 27th of March 2020 be and is hereby vacated with immediate effect.
Burundi is today, Thursday, commemorating 28 years since the assassination of its first democratically elected president. A Ghanaian official will explain his government's policy towards Liberian refugees. An agency helps Kenya's returning abused workers to reintegrate. And Zimbabwe's main opposition party alleges assassination attempt against its leader.
The onslaught on our party leader and his convoy as he conducts this Meet the People tours that started in Mashingo is unprecedented.
Botswana refused reports its rhinoceros population is on the verge of extinction due to poaching and seeking ways to restore trees and wetlands in Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Uhuru Kenyatta has lifted the nationwide dusk-to-dawn curfew imposed to curb the spread of the coronavirus. The president made the announcement yesterday, Wednesday, during Kenya's Mashujaa or Heroes Day commemoration. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, this year's Mashujaa Day commemoration, which is also President Kenyatta's last, was graced by Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera, who arrived in the country on Tuesday for a three-day official visit.
Speaking during the Mashujaa Day celebration, Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera described both countries as friends whose struggle for independence unites them both.
Kenya's joy is Malawi's joy. For us, the struggle for independence in Kenya and Malawi is one of the things that binds us together. Indeed, it is no accident that the city of Mzuzu in the north of Malawi, the city of Lilongwe in the center of Malawi, and the city of Blantyre in the south of Malawi all have at least one road named after Kenyatta.
President Uhuru Kenyatta used his speech to lift the nationwide 10 p.m. to 10 a.m. curfew.
I have further noted with much appreciation that surge of infections has declined over the last 2 weeks. Accordingly, the number of persons gathering for in-person worship is now reviewed upwards from one-third of the congregants to two-thirds, provided they adhere to all the health protocol. In the same regard, and by the authority vested in me as president, I hereby order and direct that the nationwide dusk to dawn curfew that has been in effect from the 27th of March 2020 be and is hereby vacated with immediate effect.
President Kenyatta praised health workers as a key pillar of every healthcare system, yet he said the healthcare system is often underfunded. He says in 9 years, his government has increased Kenya's health workforce by 100%.
In a bid to bridge the gap in human resources for health, the government has progressively recruited an additional 36,900 healthcare workers in the last 9 years, bringing total public health workforce to what it is today, 75,000 health workers.
The lifting of the curfew follows appeals from the Kenyan business community and churches. The directive has been highly welcomed by Kenyans, especially those who rely on the night economy. Boniface Gashoka is the Secretary General of the National Bar Owners Association.
We'd like to take this opportunity to thank His Excellency the President for giving us an opportunity to operate. We were really suffering because right now the kind of losses and the impact of COVID on us is that, one, we've been able to release, or we were able to release 250,000 employees from work. 15,000 bars were closed and the whole industry lost 150 billion. So by President Uhuru Kenyatta today, giving us the freedom to operate, that is a very positive thing, and we'd really like to appreciate him. COVID is still there, and the COVID protocols are still in force.
220 living Kenyan heroes and heroines were honored by President Kenyatta, including Ferdinand Omanyala, an avid sprinter who specializes in the 100-meter and 200-meter races and is currently the African record holder and 8th fastest man of all time in the 100 meters. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa in Nairobi, Kenya.
Zimbabwe's main opposition party says its leader, Nelson Chamisa, survived an assassination attempt on Tuesday this week while he was on a rural outreach tour meeting with community leaders. Reporter Kuzai Nabashe has details.
Chamisa's Meet the People trail has not been a pleasant one. On 11 October, his convoy was ambushed and stoned, causing significant damage to some of the vehicles. The latest incident has led his party to cry foul, citing an attempt to assassinate their leader. Tendai Biti is the deputy president of the MDC Alliance.
The onslaught on our party leader and his convoy as he conducts these Meet the People tours that started in Mashingo is unprecedented. Only yesterday, the 19th of October, 2021, his convoy was again attacked just outside Motare, around the Zimunya area, as he drove from Chipinge. An unlawful ambush was mounted, gunshots were fired, and one of the bullets actually whisked in the left rear seat, passenger seat, where he normally sits as a VIP.
Linda Masarira is the president of an opposition party, Labour Economists and African Democrats, or LEAD. She wonders who is behind the incidents.
It is really mind-boggling how Nelson Chamisa has been moving freely all these years with no problems. He campaigned freely for the elections. Then, boom, all of a sudden, because there's a UN special rapporteur in Zimbabwe, every other day there's something happening to him. Does that make sense? Does that really make sense?
Biti says the international community should pay attention to incidents.
We have a message to the international community, and our message is very simple. The regime of impunity and unaccountability continues in Zimbabwe. The people that destroyed our president's car last week, no one has been arrested. Yet there are videos that show the people committing the vandalism.
Critics worry the violence foreshadows a more chaotic and bruising political campaign ahead of the 2023 elections. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashi from Harare.
Burundi is today Thursday commemorating 28 years since the assassination of its first democratically elected Hutu president, Melchior Ndadaye. Moses Aviarimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania.
After almost three decades since the assassination of President Melchior Ndadaye, the country is still seeking truth and reconciliation following the ethnic violence that led to thousands of people losing their lives. Sylvestre Ntibantunganya, a former Burundian president, says Melchior Ndadaye inspired democracy in Burundi.
From 68 to 93, it was during the coup d'etat, but now the president of Burundi is elected. That's why I say that President Ndadaye is an important personality, because it has been the first to use the way to come into power.
One of the highlights of Burundi's bloody civil war was the assassination of President Melchior Ndadaye in 1993. After just 3 months in the office, the assassination sparked an ethnic violence between the majority Hutu and the Tutsi minority ethnic groups. Agathon Rwasa is Burundi's opposition leader.
It is upsetting to see that what he was trying to introduce in Burundi, the culture of democracy, is still lacking, as democracy is just reduced to fake elections, and when there is no good governance in every corner. To date, we are just talking about democracy, but democracy is just a dream.
The violence developed into a decade-long civil war in which more than 100,000 people died. According to a 1996 United Nations report, the Burundi Army Command was accused of being responsible for President Ndadaye's assassination. Pierre Claver Ndayicariye is the president of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. He says that they have already explained the reasons as to why the commission was formed, and its mandate was to address the truth, people to testify, and unite Burundians through acknowledging the past. The Burundian society is comprised of the Hutu, Tutsi, and the Twa ethnic groups, with more than 70% of the 11 million population being from the Hutu ethnic group. The country was ruled dominantly by the Tutsi minority since independence in 1962. The 20th anniversary of Ndadaye's assassination is being commemorated today as a public holiday throughout Burundi. Burundians differ about the level of democracy and unity in the country after 28 years. Moses Saviarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 21st. An official of the Ghana Refugee Board has been explaining the government's policy towards thousands of Liberian refugees who have been living at the Buduburam refugee camp since 1990. On Wednesday, we interview on this program Dennis Guyon, president of the Buduburam camp, who said that the Ghanaian government had not fulfilled its promise to fully integrate the refugees by giving them work permits and housing. However, Tete Paddy, executive director of the Ghana Refugee Board, says the assertion by the refugees that the Ghanaian government promised to be completely responsible for them is not factual.
We made very, very clear what constituted the local integration package. And what it was that they were getting a free Liberian passport. They didn't pay for it. It was actually paid for by UNHCR. They got a free residence permit. 50% of that residence permit was paid by Ghana government, 50% was paid by UNHCR. They got 1 year's national health insurance subscription, free, paid for by UNHCR. And then they got $400 per adult and then $150 per child. Our local integration policy stated support for shelter. Now, we made it clear to them that the support for shelter was the cash grant that was being given them. And so to say that government promised them something that had not been agreed upon, that is not documented anywhere, is untrue.
You said the government gave the refugees resident permit, is that correct?
Resident and work permit in one.
So are you saying that they can use the work permit to work in Ghana?
Many of them are using it to work. The whole idea of local integration is to make them self-sufficient. So there is no way anybody locally integrating in Ghana will not be given permission to work.
My understanding, speaking with Mr. Guyon the other day, is that the work permit says that they can only work within the vicinity of the refugee camp. Is that correct?
That is not correct. There's no work permit that restricts you to an area in Ghana. Work permits may restrict you to a company or an organization. And even with that, what is expected is that when you are changing your job, you need to inform immigration. However, in the case of Liberians locally integrating, they were told that they could use their work permit to work in any organization without having to refer back to Ghana Immigration Service. Unfortunately, the residence permit and work permit that was given them did not state specifically that they could work anywhere. It just said they were residents, and there's a pre-printed part that basically implies it's not transferable, as in you can't take it to another place of work. But we explained to them clearly that irrespective of the wording in your residence permit, you are allowed to work anywhere you choose. You're allowed to change your job at any time. And we said to them that if you have any challenges whatsoever with any potential employer, please refer them to the Ghana Immigration Service or the Ghana Refugee Board.
Mr. Paddy, is it possible that the government can correct the work permit that you're talking about? Because as you are saying, the burden goes on the refugee who, if they encounter any problem with an employer, should come back to you. But is it possible the permit can be corrected?
It is something that we have actually started discussing already that in the future we will not let it reach the way it does. So while I agree with you that yes, there's that challenge, we have always addressed it when it came up. And indeed, going forward, we've been talking about immigration. In fact, today we even had a meeting that the matter came up, and it will be changed in the future.
It's very nice to talk with you. Thank you so much, Mr. Paddy.
I'm very grateful for the opportunity. Thank you. Thank you.
That was Tete Paddy, Executive Director of the Ghana Refugee Board. He was speaking with us from the capital, Accra. Laborers from Kenya say they have endured abuse in the Middle East, often at the hands of their employers, but an aid agency is offering them a chance to rebuild their lives in Kenya. Hundreds of survivors of forced labor are now able to access a support offered by a group that offers a soft landing for those in need. Brenda Molinya reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Faith Murunga's store on the outskirts of Kenya's capital is open for business. It has been barely 6 months old in operation, helping her put food on her family's table. It isn't what she had anticipated when she left Kenya in 2019 for work in Saudi Arabia, a popular work destination for those unable to find jobs in Kenya. She says what she was promised as she emigrated and what she found there were worlds apart. She says, the boss came and told me that as long as I agreed to travel to their country, I must do each and every chore. He said, I would not have the right to complain. They had paid a lot of money to buy me. I was therefore their property. During her 2 years of service in Saudi Arabia, Murunga suffered both emotional and physical abuse at the hands of her employer until a good Samaritan came to her aid and facilitated her return to Kenya. Back home, she received help from Heart Kenya, an organization that fights human trafficking and helps people like Faith. Since Heart Kenya was formed in 2010, the organization has helped more than 700 survivors of forced labor who have come home scarred. Marcy Atieno, the organization's outreach manager, says the survivors, 80% of them women, have varying degrees of trauma when they seek help.
When a survivor comes to us, they are distressed. Some of them appear confused. They don't know what to do next. And you find someone who does not know where to start. They do not have a house. They don't want to go back home because everyone knows they went abroad. So they're expecting that they will come with something.
The organization takes in survivors of forced labor and other work-related abuses and helps them rebuild their lives through counseling, training, and supporting their ability to make a living. Marcy Atieno explains.
This process is actually a very participatory process where it's the caseworker and the survivor chatting with them to which they are going to work together for proper rehabilitation. So the survivor has a voice and they can actually say no to a service because our services are individualized and they are survivor-centered.
Thank you, my sister. My name is...
The Kenya Union of Domestic Hotels, Educational Institutes, Hospitals and Allied Workers, or Ogudeha, the union that fights for the rights of workers, says the migration of workers to the Middle East is likely to continue as long as Kenya's 10% unemployment rate stays as high as it is. Albert Njeru, the union's general secretary, advises those seeking work as unskilled labor abroad to be extra vigilant.
Seek for proper information. Consult widely. And before you go, get it right. Don't go where you can see black spots.
Heart Kenya's leadership says it is ready to handle cases like Faith's as they appear. For now, Faith says she's grateful for another chance at life away from the abuse she suffered in a foreign land. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
Botswana wildlife authorities have refuted reports that the country's rhinoceros population is on the verge of extinction due to poaching. The Southern African country has battled a rise in poaching with more than 60 animals killed in the last 2 years. Security forces have responded by gunning down 24 poachers during the same period. Umkundise Dube reports from Habaroni.
Department of Wildlife and National Parks Director Kabelo Sinyatso says both rhinoceros and elephant poaching remain under control. In a statement addressing poaching concerns, Sinyatso says the government is committed to protecting the key species. Sinyatso added, while isolated reports of poaching both the rhino and elephant continue to be reported, the government's anti-poaching efforts are making progress. But conservationist Neil Feet argues poaching incidents could have dropped due to the decrease in the number of rhinoceroses in the Okavango Delta.
The rhino poaching may have subsided only just because there's a lot less numbers there. Elephant poaching, there is still happening, but we're getting very little reports through because the government isn't actually saying anything that's happening at all.
In a bid to stem the poaching tide, government security forces have killed more than 20 poachers in the last 2 years as part of a zero-tolerance campaign that Botswana has enforced since 2013. Feet says a multi-stakeholder approach to fighting poaching is key to conserving particularly the endangered species.
The best type of thing that we can do is to make sure that we all work together. That's the government, private sector, and NGOs. Sometimes you need to put your hands up and say, hey, we got a problem, we need to sort it, and we need everyone to help. And we're open to all ideas, not just ideas that we like.
Former Director at Rhino Conservation Botswana, Mep Ives, says there's need for an intelligence-based approach to counter poaching.
That intelligence comes in several layers. You need local intelligence within the Okavango Delta. You need local plus intelligence, which is surrounding the Okavango Delta. And then you need regional intelligence. That is from the countries surrounding Botswana, Namibia, Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe. And then you need international intelligence. And this sort of intelligence requires a high level of trust between not only government, but between private sector and NGOs.
According to a 2021 International Rhino Foundation status report released last month, the rhino population faces a significant poaching threat in Botswana. But the report notes the government is taking steps, including dehorning the rhinos, to make them less attractive to poachers and relocating the animals to safer places. Mkondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone.
Researchers and experts at the African Open Deal are building a physical baseline to know more about trees and wetlands on the continent, to know what is available for potential restoration. The project began out of the Great Green Wall, but has expanded to include all of the continent. Mukhtar Sakande, focal point for the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, talked to Ricky Stryak about the digital approach that they are using to monitor land use and change.
We start mapping digitally the Great Green Wall Corridor. In the framework of that exercise with the country partners, we have been asked by the leadership and the member country to extend that nationally, the whole Great Green Wall countries, instead of just the corridor.
What kind of things did you guys find out that maybe you didn't know that impacted the development of the Great Green Wall?
Yes, what we found out is just that from the countries, for example, perspective, you know, nobody knew really the extent of the Great Green Wall. Initially, it was just said, you know, 15 kilometers wide and the 8,000 kilometers long. But apart from that, there's no indication what it is, how big it is, what sort of lands are available really for restoration and so on and so forth. So that's how we started really monitoring. And it's been expanded now to all 11 countries of the Great Green Wall. And we have been pushing that now because of the demand, the request from the member countries. We expanded that to the whole continent.
Can you explain why this data is helpful moving forward, not just for the Great Green Wall, but for a person who lives in one of these countries?
What is the value of this sort of data? First, you know, we wanted to demonstrate that really without the data, for example, it's just like we're shooting in the dark. How far can we restore? What can we restore? And what is the extent of our operation? And above all, how can you monitor where you are in terms of progress and in terms of what you're doing? You know now that for the Great Green Wall, the target is to restore 100 million by 2030. With the Africa Forest Landscape and Restoration Program, the AFR 100, and also the African Union, the target is 100 million hectares by 2030.
That was Mokhtar Sakande, focal point for the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Rome. And that's it for this Thursday, October 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day.